The topic today is that I gave is the corrupt origins of central banking in the U.S., in America. And the economic angle to the introduction to this is that in all the so-called market failure literature, even the literature that is discussed by supposedly free market economists like the Chicago School economists, they take institutions like central banking and antitrust, and the general story is that, well, there was a legitimate market failure at some point in history that needed to be remedied by government intervention. And that's the story of antitrust regulation that is told. But I think I debunked that in my old article entitled The Origins of Antitrust way back in 1984 in the International Review of Law and Economics, showing that there was no cartelization or monopolization problem at that time anyway. And so, but the approach to antitrust regulation that the Chicago School economists have always taken is that to believe in this myth that there was some sort of market failure originally, sort of an original sin theory of market failure, of government intervention, but it has all gone awry by dumb regulators. And if only you put smart guys like us Chicago economists in charge, then we'll do it right. We'll regulate the right way. And the Chicago School has pretty much said the same thing about banking, about central banking. The great debates between the monetarists and Keynesians that occurred in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, the 80s, you know, for decades, was all about who is a better central planner, Milton Friedman or James Tobin? Tobin being the famous Nobel Prize economist from Yale, or name any other Keynesian. So you had Friedman and his colleagues on one side saying, well, our monetary rule could do better. And then you had the Keynesians on the other side saying, no, we want a more activist central planning type Fed. But no one questioned the existence of the Fed or alternatives to the Fed as an institution because of the belief in this myth that the Fed somehow corrected some sort of failure in the marketplace and is an essential institution. And so in this discussion of mine, which is based on a paper of mine that was in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics a while back, I'm gonna make a case that central banking in America always was intended to do things that had nothing to do with improving markets. It always had everything to do with expanding the size and scope of government beyond what the Constitution would allow, and in creating a financing vehicle for political corruption. There are smoking guns everywhere. There are actual quotations from the original advocates of central banking saying these things. And so where this idea came from that the Fed was some sort of response to market failure is just totally a concoction of somebody's imagination. The court historians have said that. And I'll start with quoting Murray Rothbard in his book, The Mystery of Banking. He wrote that the first national bank in the U.S. was called the Bank of North America. And here's what Rothbard wrote. He said it was driven through the Continental Congress by Philadelphia Congressman and financier Robert Morris in the spring of 1781. And Morris was the financial leader of the nationalists, the group in early America who wanted a powerful central government. And they also wanted to bring the system of British mercantilism to America. British mercantilism, they wanted to bring high protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare for politically connected industries, large public debt, and the central bank to pay for it all. That was British mercantilism. Those are some of the aspects of British mercantilism, and tie it to a centralized government run essentially by a king, where there were really no states' rights or state sovereignty at all. Because after all, you can't have, in a federation like the early American colonies, you could not have a protectionist tariff policy unless all the colonies were forced into it. Because you would have the threat of somebody like South Carolina, for example, saying, we want free trade. And so if you had New York with 50% tariff rates on imports coming into New York Harbor and 0% tariff rates on imports coming into Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, well, then the trade from Europe would all go into Charleston. and the New York ports would just dry up economically. It wouldn't work. And so you need to enforce it on everyone. And that was always the idea behind why the nationalists at the very beginning of the American Republic wanted a powerful central government. In fact, it was Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary, who at the Constitutional Convention laid out their plan for the government. Their plan was a permanent president who would appoint all the governors of the states, and the governors could have veto power over any legislation that any state legislature would pass. So the governors would all be puppets of the king, and the puppets of the king could be fired on the spot by the king if they did not veto legislation passed by state legislatures that the king disapproved of. And the opponents of this system were the Jeffersonians, and they correctly pointed out that, wait a minute, we just fought a revolution against this very system. Why would we want to bring it here to America? Well, the answer to that question is obvious. The answer to the question is that it is a bad thing if you're on the paying end of a mercantilist empire, because all you do is pay, pay, pay. But it's a good thing if you're on the collecting end. And the nationalists figured to be the ones on the collecting end, the beneficiary of this system. After all, this system existed in Europe for many, many decades because it benefited somebody. It wouldn't have existed if it didn't benefit the political class, and that's who it benefited. And so Robert Morris was the money man behind this, and Rothbard referred to Hamilton as, his exact words were, Morris's youthful disciple. There. And here's furthermore, this is what Rothbard said was what they were after. They wanted, and I'm quoting Murray Rothbard in page 192 of The Mystery of Banking, they wanted, quote, to reimpose in the new United States a system of mercantilism and big government similar to that in Great Britain, against which the colonists had rebelled. The object was to have a strong central government, particularly a strong president or king as chief executive, built up by high taxes and heavy public debt. The strong government was to impose high tariffs to subsidize domestic manufacturers, develop a big navy to open up and subsidize foreign markets for American exports, and launch a massive system of internal public works. In short, the United States was to have a British system without Great Britain. End quote. That was Rothbard saying this. And then he goes on to say that an important part of this, Murray called it the Morris scheme. Murray liked to use words like scheme, scam. He was really good at that. The Morris scheme was to organize and head a central bank to provide cheap credit and expanded money for himself and his allies. The Bank of North America was deliberately modeled after the Bank of England. So that was really the cornerstone. A national bank was always the cornerstone of this whole scheme to bring the whole rotten, corrupt British mercantilist system here. If any of you ever saw that old movie, History of the World, Part 2, where Mel Brooks plays the King of France, and he keeps saying things like, it's good to be the king. You know, every time he has, you know, he's sitting on piles of gold or something like that, he looks right into the camera and says, it's good to be the king. Well, that basically was the philosophy of the nationalists. It's bad if you're on the paying end of a mercantilist empire, but it's good to be the king. That's why they literally proposed a king. They called it a permanent president, that he would be in office as long as he behaved well, they said. And who was to decide whether he behaved well? Well, him himself, the king himself. I guess he's the judge of his own behavior. He's the king, after all. And so that's the type of system. And, of course, that was totally rejected at the Constitutional Convention immediately, and Hamilton threw a hissy fit and went home. He was only there for like a day or two and went home. And then when they finally passed and ratified the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton called it a frail and worthless fabric, because it did not institute his plan of a king with highly centralized dictatorial power that would impose British-style mercantilism on the whole country. And eliminate states' rights altogether. And how did a guy like Hamilton become Treasury Secretary? He probably knew no more than the average freshman who is attending Mises University this week about economics and finance, literally. He was George Washington's young assistant during the Revolution, And he must have been very good at what would be the scientific word for that? Butt kissing, I think, would be the like that. A man, 20-year-old man, being the assistant to this most powerful man in the country. But Hamilton's biographer, Ron Chernow, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Alexander Hamilton about 7 or 8 years ago or so, he explained how Hamilton got the job as Treasury Secretary. And here's what Ron Chernow wrote. It was near the end of the Revolution, and he knew he was going to need a job. Okay, he's George Washington's assistant in the American Revolution, but the war was almost over, and he was looking for a job. So naturally, he's working for George Washington. He writes the richest man in the country for a job. So yeah, why not? Why not start at the top? And so what did he do? He did this, says Ron Chernow. Hamilton brushed up on money matters because he didn't know anything about money matters. So he had to brush up. And he had Colonel Timothy Pickering. This was Colonel Pickering was George Washington's adjutant general who would later be Secretary of State under President George Washington. So he had Colonel Timothy Pickering send him some primers, David Hume's political discourses, tracts written by an English clergyman and polemicist Richard Price, and his all-purpose crib, Postlethwaite's Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce. So he read a dictionary. A dictionary. Hamilton then sent a marathon letter. This was a 30-page letter, which is online. You can read it. Hamilton's letter to Robert Morris. That set forth a full-fledged system for shoring up American credit and creating a national bank. Now, these are Ron Chernow's words, that the letter called for a full-fledged system for shoring up American credit and creating a national bank. Well, what Hamilton was up to is he knew what Robert Morris was up to. The whole Bank of North America episode showed that the Nationalists wanted a central bank first and foremost, that would subsidize corporations, provide cheap credit for politically connected businesses, and subsidize all forms of corporate welfare. They would protect American manufacturers with high protective tariffs, high taxes, high debt, in a big government that would pursue empire and what Hamilton called imperial glory. In other words, they wanted to be the British Empire, whereas the Jeffersonians talked about an empire of liberty. They didn't want to be imperialists. They wanted the opposite. And so the letter, what did this letter, if you read the letter, which is online, and I actually have the URL right here, he advocated high protectionist tariffs, central bank, taxes on land, which we did get, the Americans did get during the Washington administration. There was a property tax that led to the Shays Rebellion in New England after it. They wanted poll taxes, only the right people can vote, and a large public debt. Now, Hamilton's Machiavellian side, there's even a book called The American Machiavelli about Alexander Hamilton, and he advocated a large public debt, not to finance roads or anything like that, but because he knew that a large national debt would create a situation where the holders of government bonds, would be mostly the wealthiest people in the country, and that they would then form a powerful political lobby behind bigger government and higher taxes, because they would always want to make sure there was enough tax money in the Treasury to pay off the principal and interest on their bonds. And that's why he said this. Hamilton said, "A national debt, if not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It will be powerful cement of our union." Okay, and so he said, if not excessive, and then he spent the rest of his life doing everything he could possibly do to make sure that government spending was as excessive as possible, and debt. So he was lying when he said that. I pretty much proved this in my book, Hamilton's Curse. And so that's why he wanted a large debt. It was a political reason. Okay, the linchpin of all of this was the creation of a central bank. And here's another thing Hamilton said about why we supposedly needed a central bank. He made a speech talking about how great it was that that England had a central bank. He said, "The tendency of a national bank is to increase public and private credit." Good, the more the better. He wrote, and he said, and this is in his letter to Robert Morris, he says, the former gives power to the state for the protection of its rights and interests. So it's important to increase the power of the state to protect its rights. And of course, whenever the state gains power, individuals lose freedom. And so that's what he was arguing for. We need a bank to enlarge the state. There's a biography of Hamilton by William Graham Sumner, the great early 19th century libertarian from Yale University, who is really critical. And he pretty much accuses Hamilton of believing in voodoo economics. He uses all kind of phrases like mysticism to describe Hamilton's views. But there's another author named Douglas Adair, who was one of the editors of the Federalist Papers. There have been many editions of the Federalist Papers. And in a 1980 edition of the Federalist Papers, on page 171, Douglas Adair, the editor, explained what Hamilton and his party were up to. He said this: with devious brilliance, Hamilton set out by a program of class legislation to unite the propertied interests of the Eastern Seaboard into a cohesive administration party, while at the same time he attempted to make the executive dominant over Congress by a lavish use of the spoils system. In carrying out his scheme, Hamilton transformed every financial transaction of the Treasury Department into an orgy of speculation and graft, in which selected senators, congressmen, and certain of their richer constituents throughout the nation participated. And so when he was as Treasury Secretary, he used every spending bill, everything he could do to essentially buy the votes of members of Congress for the agenda of the nationalists. Now, this agenda was given a name by Hamilton. It was called the American System. And then long after Hamilton's death, the American System became the object of the Whig Party under Henry Clay. And Henry Clay is most known for being the advocate of the American system, but the phrase was literally coined by Hamilton himself. And so we have all, beginning in the 1790s, we have the nationalists wanting this American system, which is really the British system brought to America, advocated by the Whigs and then the Republicans. When the Republican Party was created in the 1850s, it was the Republicans who carried forward this sort of neo-mercantilist banner. And Abe Lincoln was the foremost proponent of that. There was, no one was a bigger proponent of bringing back a nationalized bank than Abe Lincoln was, and as a member of the Whig Party during the 25 years or so when he was a Whig. And so this was a long battle. This was like the long march through the institutions, as the communists would say, to adopt this this system. And so that's what the nationalists were up to, using the powers of government to buy votes in whatever way they could from members of Congress to get them to vote for this system, the American system: central banking, corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs, big public debt, and so forth. And so the first gambit of Hamilton as Treasury Secretary was when they nationalized the war debt from the Revolutionary War. The insiders in Washington, this was before the internet, by the way. So the insiders in Washington knew that the government had planned on buying up all the old debt, outstanding debt, at par value, at face value. But at the time, it was trading at maybe between 2 and 10% of that value. So if you had a bond that was worth, say, a $100 bond, it was trading at maybe between $2 and $10. And so there were all these bonds out there. A lot of them were in the hands of old Revolutionary War veterans who, when the Continental Congress didn't have the money, they gave them promises. They gave them bonds, government bonds. And they said, someday in the future, these will be worth some money. And so there were all these bonds outstanding out there. And so what they did was the insiders, the political insiders, and you talk about insider trading, they knew, they and only they knew this. They knew that within a few months, if you bought one of these bonds for, say, the equivalent of $2, the government would buy it from you for $100. That's a pretty good arbitrage opportunity. And so they literally used every means of transportation they could get their hands on: horses, stagecoaches, boats, ferries, and went all up and down the Eastern Seaboard trying to buy up as many of these bonds as they could from unsuspecting and unknowing Revolutionary War veterans and others. There's an old biography of Hamilton and Jefferson by Claude Bowers, B-O-W-E-R-S. I think it's called Jefferson and Hamilton. And he explains what was happening. Here's his paragraph on this. Expresses, meaning stagecoaches, expresses with very large sums of money were on their way to North Carolina for purposes of speculation in certificates. They splashed and bumped over wretched winter roads. Two fast-sailing vessels chartered by a member of Congress who had been an officer in the war were plowing the waters southward on a similar mission. And so there was, you get this idea of a mad rush of people with big chests full of money, you know, going down to buy all these bonds on the cheap from unsuspected owners of the bonds. And so how much money did they make on this? Well, Bowers writes that Robert Morris himself made $18 million. Governor George Clinton of New York made $5 million. Hamilton himself purchased some of the bonds, quote, through buying agents in Philadelphia and New York. So Hamilton himself made millions on this. And if you read this famous biography of Hamilton by Ron Chernow, it's almost as bad as the Lincoln biographies in that there's an excuse for everything. You know, I've read a lot of the Lincoln stuff, and every book I pick up, if it's not my own, almost every book, it sounds like a defense brief in the war crimes trial of Abraham Lincoln. You know, it's just an odious deed after odious deed, and then 30 pages of excuses of it. And so when you get to the part in Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton personally profiting from this scam that he created, he says the bonds were probably for his brother-in-law; they weren't for him. So, those of you young people in the audience, you're not married. If you're looking to get married, find a brother-in-law like Alexander Hamilton, who will make millions of dollars and then just give it all to you. In another passage, Ron Chernow writes that Alexander Hamilton once purchased 6 slaves at a slave auction. And then he calls him an abolitionist in another passage. And then guess what he says after the passage where he says he bought 6 slaves at a slave auction? I already gave you a hint. What do you think he says? They were for his brother-in-law. So that makes it okay to buy slaves, as long as you give them away. That's the welfare state mentality, isn't it? It's okay for the government to plunder you as long as they give the money to the poor people, you know, or to Exxon, whoever they give the money, you know, some other worthy group like that. You know, it's okay to steal and plunder. But that's what he says. And so this is obviously what's going on. And Jefferson himself has smoked out Hamilton and his cronies. He knew exactly what was going on. Jefferson wrote an essay on February 4th, 1818. This was long after Hamilton's death. Hamilton died in 1804. He was shot by in the Aaron Burr in the famous duel. Hold your applause, please. We have to get this lecture over with. And Gary North, who's going to be here Saturday, by the way, he once told me that he started up an Aaron Burr Society once, and their logo was Not Soon Enough. The Aaron Burr Society. And so, anyway, in this essay, in this 1818 essay, this is what Thomas Jefferson wrote. He wrote that, quote, Hamilton's financial system had two objects. First, as a puzzle to exclude popular understanding and inquiry, and secondly, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature. And so this financial schemes of his, Jefferson is saying, were intentionally confusing so that the public could never understand what they're doing. I mean, it sounds like Wall Street today, doesn't it? Who the heck knows what these people do with money? To this day, the Fed hasn't been audited. So, you know, by definition, we have no idea really what the Fed does with all this money. And so Jefferson, here's Jefferson in 1818 saying this and warning about it. And so the second part of that, the corruption of the legislature, because after all, he had observed Hamilton using tax dollars to buy votes from members of Congress to get them to vote for the bank bill and corporate welfare subsidies, protectionist tariffs, all these things. You know, why wouldn't he use other means besides direct payments from tax dollars of this? And so Here's what Jefferson said further about Hamilton. He said, in terms of Hamilton's view of government, and it wasn't just Hamilton, it was his whole party that still existed. It was his political heirs he's describing, not just this one man, because they ultimately did prevail in America in the 1860s. The Hamiltonians did. In fact, a former student of mine, Vedran Vuk, just sent me an email about an hour ago with an article from Politico about the Canadian neocon David Frum. There's an interview with him saying that if he were president, he would erect a statue of Alexander Hamilton on the White House lawn. And so, so the Hamiltonians are still plaguing us. They're still there. They pretty much run the Democratic and Republican parties today. But here's what Jefferson said of these people. He said that Hamilton avowed the opinion that man could be governed by one of two motives only, force or self-interest. Force, he observed, in this country was out of the question, and the interest, therefore, of the members of Congress must be laid hold of to keep the legislature in unison with the executive, executive power, okay? And with grief and shame, it must be acknowledged that his machine was not without effect, that even in this, the birth of our government, some members were found sordid enough to bend their duty to their interests, their self-interest, and to look after their personal rather than the public good. He's referring to this arbitrage scheme that I just read to you about. And he goes on to say, the distresses of those people, that is, the original bondholders who were ripped off, he says, often oblige them to part with these bonds for the half, the fifth, even a tenth of their value, and speculators had made a trade of cozening them from the holders by the most fraudulent practices and persuasions. So Thomas Jefferson understood exactly what went on with this arbitrage scheme that Claude Bowers wrote about in the 1920s. But this, he goes further. Jefferson says this, men thus enriched, he's talking about members of Congress who are enriched by this, by the dexterity of a leader, that is, they owe it all to Hamilton, would follow, of course, the chief who was leading them to fortune, and thus become the zealous instruments of all his political enterprises. So Hamilton would be their leader. He was letting them in on deals that would make them all millionaires. This, of course, sounds like every member of Congress I've ever heard of. You know, they all retire as millionaires, don't they? You know, how did Bob Dole become worth tens of millions? He was a public servant his whole life, wasn't he? You know, you ever wonder about that, a guy like that? So this is nothing new, in other words. But there's a problem here, okay? Let's see. The problem that Jefferson pointed out was this arbitrage scheme where they nationalized the war debt was a one-time only scheme. You know, they made their money. It's a one-time thing. The debt is nationalized. It's over with. And so the members of Congress who were bought off by the Federalists, the Nationalists, they would eventually retire or die. And so they'd have to do it all over again. They'd have to buy off a whole new generation of politicians to get their plan in place. And that takes a lot of money. Where are they going to get the money? Well, they had the money from the bonds, but that's all gone. Okay? Where could they do it? So Jefferson goes on to explain this. He says, some engine of influence more permanent must be contrived. This is Thomas Jefferson describing these people. He says, this engine was the Bank of the United States. So in other words, a central bank, a national bank that could print money, fiat money, was needed to be a permanent engine of corruption, okay, to permanently allow these people to buy off members of Congress to pursue their ultimate objective of imposing a British-style mercantilist system on America. Why did Jefferson believe this? He said he believed this because, quote, Hamilton was not only a monarchist, which he was. He advocated he didn't use the word monarchy, but permanent president. Hamilton was not only a monarchist, but for a monarchy bottomed on corruption, based on, held in place, held in power by corruption. And why did Jefferson believe this? Well, he goes on to recall a dinner that he had, and he says, and he tells a story about this dinner, and he says, for the truth of which I attest the God who made me. So, honest to God, this is true, Thomas Jefferson is saying. He recalled a dinner that he had with Hamilton himself, Secretary of War Henry Knox, John Adams, President John Adams, and the U.S. Attorney General, Edmund Randolph. And he says, here's what the conversation was. John Adams, President John Adams, was talking about the British Constitution. And he said this, purge that Constitution of its corruption and give to its popular branch, that is the legislature, equality of representation with the executive, and it would be the most perfect constitution ever devised by the wit of man. So John Adams is saying he likes the British Constitution, which has never been a written constitution, by the way. It was just the evolution of laws and customs, unwritten, but purge it of its corruption and make the legislature more equal to the executive. It would be the most perfect, brilliant constitution ever devised by the wit of man. And then Hamilton enters the conversation. And Jefferson says that Hamilton was so bewitched and perverted by the British example as to be under thorough conviction that corruption was essential to the government of a nation. So Hamilton stepped in here and said, oh, no, you're wrong. The corruption part is the good part of the British Constitution. It would become worthless if you didn't have the corruption in there. And he said, here's how I put it. Well, that's enough of the quotes. But that's the point Hamilton made, because it was the corruption that kept the system going. It was the corruption, just as I've already described. I have a big, long quote here, but I don't want to. It kind of gets boring with too many big, long quotes. And so that was his opinion. So that's why Thomas Jefferson was of the opinion that, one, the purpose of this central bank that the Morris disciples wanted was as the financial vehicle for the British mercantilist system brought to America. And also, point two, in that it was essentially going to be used to generate perpetual corruption in politics. Okay, there was no talk of the failure of markets. There were banks. They had banks. They didn't need a government. They did not need a bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital. What a good idea that was. We already have banks, and here come the Federalists saying, hey, let's create another bank, but let's run it by politicians from the nation's capital, and let's make it secret so no one knows about it. And let's have some private owners who will finance part of it so that they will have a vested economic interest in it and can profit by it and will be our supporters and help us keep this bank in place forever. That's a good idea. That's what happened. There was no market failure that happened here, and so that was part of the argument. And of course, the first bank of North America went bankrupt. Even though it was given a monopoly in currency issue, its currency was so untrustworthy that it was privatized within just a couple of years. That's why the Federalists had to resort to this crusade led by Alexander Hamilton to resurrect a central bank, which became the Bank of the United States. And so there was another great debate between Jefferson and Hamilton over this, the Bank of the United States. And let's see what time we have here. Okay. And so they had this other great debate where George Washington actually asked Jefferson and Hamilton to offer their opinions on the constitutionality and desirability of a national bank. Jefferson, this is the prototypical example of Jefferson's strict constructionist view of the Constitution. He looked through all the delegated powers. There was no powers for a central bank. The notes, Madison's notes of the Constitutional Convention tell us that they actually did discuss a national bank and rejected it at the Constitutional Convention. That would seem to be evidence, Jefferson said, that it's not constitutional because the Constitutional Convention itself rejected a national bank. And Hamilton came back by inventing the idea of implied powers of the Constitution. He said, yes, there are these explicitly delegated powers in Article 1, Section 8, but if you read between the lines, there are also implied powers. And then Jefferson came back and essentially said, I've read between the lines. I only see blank space. I don't see any implied anything there. And he didn't use those literal words, but that's the essence of what his argument was. And so, this is where Hamilton relied on the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution that says that the Congress has the power to raise taxes to carry out the necessary and proper functions of government. So they had an argument over the words necessary and proper. Hamilton said it's necessary to have a bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital. And Jefferson responded by saying, no, it's just convenience. It's not necessary. We have banks. We can put the money, tax dollars, in banks we already have. We don't need a government bank. But we did get the bank. George Washington signed the legislation, but it was not on the strength of Hamilton's argument. It was political corruption that led to the bank. At the time, they were moving the nation's capital from New York City to Virginia, and they were going to create Washington, D.C. George Washington was a big landowner. I think he was the largest or one of the largest landowners in America during his day, and he owned a lot of land in Virginia, Mount Vernon. And he wanted the nation's capital to be right adjacent to his property in Mount Vernon. And so he wanted the Federalist Party, who were advocating the bank, he wanted them to redraw the map of Washington, D.C. so it would abut his property in Virginia. And he told them, if you do this, I'll vote for the bank. And so they did. They redrew the map of Washington, D.C., which increased the value of George Washington's property, and he signed the legislation. That's how he got the Bank of the United States. And then, as Murray Rothbard pointed out in his History of Money and Banking in the United States, he wrote this: the result of the bank was the outpouring of credit and paper money by the new Bank of the United States caused an increase in prices of 72% from 1791 to 1796. So it immediately created price inflation, boom and bust cycles. Some of the money was used to finance political campaigns, just as Jefferson warned it would. And so the bank had a 20-year charter, and the charter was not renewed after the first 20 years because why? Well, it created price inflation, it created boom and busts, it created corruption, but that's what they wanted. That's what the Hamiltonians wanted it to do. They wanted to create all these things. That's the virtue of the bank from their perspective. So it did exactly what they wanted to do. And then because of the War of 1812, the bank was resurrected in 1816. They wanted to bring back the Bank of the United States to help monetize the war debt from the War of 1812, and it did. It helped to do some of that, and it went back into business in 1817. And I believe it's not just a coincidence that the title of Murray Rothbard's doctoral dissertation was "The Panic of 1819." That was Murray's. It's a book that is for sale downstairs. And so it created the Panic of 1819, the first really big, large-scale unemployment in America, right after the Bank of the United States was brought into being. As a result, it had to have had a lot to do with that. And so so the bank had its critics. Once again, it created that the Panic of 1819. And by the way, that's what depressions or recessions were known as, panics, until Herbert Hoover decided it was too harsh a term. So he decided to start using the word depression. He thought depression would cause less panic among the public if it were a depression instead of a panic. So I don't know what they should call it. What is it called now anyway? It's called quantitative easing or something. When I was in school, we called it inflationary monetary policy, but now it's quantitative easing. It makes it feel like you're sitting down in a pile of dollar bills, doesn't it? You know, it's quantitative easing. The language is pretty deceptive. And so we had the Second Bank of the United States, did much of the same thing. And the mortal enemy of the Bank of the United States turned out to be Andrew Jackson, President Andrew Jackson, who eventually vetoed the bill to refund the bank during his time. And so that by the mid-1830s, the Second Bank of the United States was on its way out. And there's an interesting story about that. There were anti-Fed, and it wasn't called the Fed, but there were central bank haters all over America, all over the states. And so there was, Ron Paul probably could have, if he was alive in 1840, he probably could have been elected president. In fact, the guy who did become president, John Tyler, when William Henry Harrison died, he was a pretty libertarian guy. There's a book called Recarving Rushmore, written by Ivan Eland, ranks the American presidents according to how good a job they did in protecting rights to life, liberty, and property. And he ranks John Tyler number one, whereas all the other the left-wing historians mention people like Tyler way down at the bottom. It's always their criterion is whoever gets us in the biggest war that kills the most people and spends the most money, that's the great presidents. But if you look at protection of life, liberty, and property, Ivan Elon puts John Tyler. Whoever heard of John Tyler, number one. But Ron Paul could have been John Tyler. He could have fit right. Could have fit right in there. And he was from Virginia, John Tyler. But when Jackson had a lot of help, and there's my favorite story about this is how in the state of Ohio, the Bank of the United States set up two branches. And the people of Ohio didn't want this. They knew that it had a record of corrupting politics. They didn't want this bank from Washington, D.C. showing up and interfering in their elections, for one thing. They didn't want the politically connected to get unfair advantage and credit by this bank. They knew that's what it was doing. And they were scared of boom and bust cycles also. And so they imposed a $50,000 a year tax on each branch. And the Bank of the United States refused to pay the tax, so the state of Ohio sent armed marshals into the bank and took the money at gunpoint. They had armed marshals from the state of Ohio went in there, jumped over the counter, and they brought big chests with them, and they filled up the chest with $50,000 from each bank and carried it off. And then they eventually had to give the money back. And other states did the same thing. Maryland did something similar. So there are other states all over that were trying to get rid of this menace of a national bank. And it led to a famous Supreme Court case, McCulloch versus Maryland, where some of you probably are familiar with one of the slogans from that case. It came from Chief Justice John Marshall, that the power to tax is the power to destroy. He was referring to the ability of states like Maryland to impose taxes on a federal government enterprise that would destroy the federal government enterprise. That's what he was referring to. The power to tax the Bank of the United States is the power to destroy the Bank of the United States. And the people in places like Ohio and Maryland were saying, well, yeah, that's the whole idea. Yeah, we know that. Well, you know, the brilliant John Marshall, what do you tell us something we don't know? And so of course, Marshall was a Hamiltonian. In fact, his statement, his big opinion in the McCulloch versus Maryland, long passages are almost plagiarized verbatim from Hamilton's opinion on the constitutionality of the United States. And so he issued this big, long-winded opinion saying that the National Bank is constitutional. Andrew Jackson responded by saying, in essence, thank you for your opinion, but my opinion is different. Good luck to you. This was back in the days when Americans did not look at the black robe deities of the Supreme Court as God, where it was just one branch of government. We have three branches. We also have the people of the states. And the idea was everybody has an equal opinion on what is and is not constitutional. Okay, we didn't wait for John Roberts to tell us socialized medicine is in Article 1, Section 8, after all, of the Constitution. President Andrew Jackson would have given John Roberts the big middle finger. And in fact, on another case that was decided by Marshall, Jackson told him, he said, Mr. Marshall has made his opinion. Now let him try to enforce it. And so he was just challenging him. You know, I have an army, he was saying. I'm the president. I have an army. Come on over. Try to enforce your opinion. But that's the way things were until the Civil War. It was only after the Civil War that the government declared a monopoly on constitutional interpretation by the Supreme Court. It didn't happen. And so that bank was eradicated. And so by 1840, there was no more national bank. There was government regulation of various sorts. There was interventionism, but there was no national bank. And then during that time, there's a big, giant history of the Whig Party, history of the American Whig Party, this thick by Michael Holt, the University of Virginia history professor. And in that book, he says that no member of the Whig Party was a more vociferous proponent of bringing back the National Bank than Abraham Lincoln was. And so when Lincoln was president, he didn't bring back the National Bank, but we did get the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts, which went a long way toward nationalizing the money supply. And it also imposed taxes on other currencies to drive them out of the market. And so it did go a long way by the time you get to the American Civil War of renationalizing, of nationalizing the currency. There was a major stepping stone to the Fed, which didn't come until 1913, of course. So maybe I'll end there. That's my story about the early origins of how we had central banking and the reasons for it. It was to grow the government through corruption. And so, you know, there's something to this guy, Ron Paul, when he says these things, and he is so viciously attacked by other members of Congress and other people like Paul Krugman, who simply don't know what they're talking about. In fact, I literally heard Bernanke say on television in one of these hearings that, well, before we had the Fed, there was all this volatility in financial markets, and the Fed solved all that. He didn't seem... Bernanke, his claim to fame in academia was economic history. He's supposedly an economic historian. He doesn't seem to know anything at all about banking history to me. When I hear him say these things, how could he say this? That there was no, that the cause of all the turmoil was the free market and money, and that the solution was always a national bank. Every time this thing came into being in 1913, the Fed, what does it do? It helps finance World War I. And then, and that led to the Great Depression of 1920, which was even worse than the first year of the Great Depression of 1930. And so, you know, where's the record of the Fed or any other version of the National Bank leading to economic stability? It's just not there. But that's the mantra of Bernanke. And I also recall seeing him on television sneering at the idea that free markets could work in the financial arena. And he's one of the people who stupidly assumes that there was no regulation. That's why we had the Great Recession. Greenspan deregulated everything, didn't he? And that's what has been the mantra of some people. And but anyway, maybe I'll stop there, and we'll have time for a few questions. What time do we have to leave here? We started at 2:30, so we have some time for some Q&A or brilliant pronouncements. If anyone has a brilliant announcement or even a stupid announcement. We have 10 minutes.
A while back, there was an HBO series about John Adams.
Yeah.
And Hamilton's appearance there is very brief. And I believe what he wanted, there's like this scheme where, I don't know whether it was he wanted to like either kick Portugal out of South America or the Spanish out of South America or both. Like he wanted to go to war over, you know, I guess, you know, liberating South America. And, John Adams
Yeah.
I'm sure it actually happened, but do you have any details on that?
John Adams became better and better from my perspective in his older age, but he was pretty horrible as president in general. He didn't do all bad things, but he enforced the Sedition Act, which made free speech illegal in America. This is what led to Thomas Jefferson writing the Kentucky Resolution of 1798. At the request of his friend Senator John Breckinridge of Kentucky, which essentially said that the people of Kentucky will not enforce the Sedition Act. And there was a Virginia version of that also. So there was the Virginia Resolution of 1798. And so John Adams purged free speech in America is one of the things that he did. And he also appointed John Marshall as Chief Justice. And for those two reasons, Ivan Elin ranks him as one of the worst presidents in history, just for those two things. But that doesn't mean he did everything wrong. But yeah, Hamilton, this is why all the neocons love Hamilton. Pat Buchanan loves Hamilton. In fact, when I was on MSNBC, when my book Hamilton's Curse came on, they put me on the Morning Joe show, and they sat me down next to Patrick J. Buchanan. And the first thing he said was, Hamilton was my hero. And so they let me talk for about 2 seconds and then shouted me down pretty much for all that. You know, William Crystal, David Brooks, David Frum, all the chicken hawk neocon warmongers, they all love Hamilton. You know, who was it? Which neocon said every once in a while we should take some crappy little country and kick the crap out of it and just to show them we know how to do it? I think it was David Brooks. He said that's what Hamilton was like. He, you know, when he wanted to invade tiny South American countries just to flex our muscle. He talked about imperial glory, but for who? You know, the average farmer in Kentucky. What's in it for him? Imperial glory, nothing, nothing. When you have an empire, all that's in it, the people are tax slaves and cannon fodder in an empire. That's what the American Revolution was fought against the government that would treat the people as tax slaves and cannon fodder. But, you know, somebody gets to collect all those taxes, and someone gets to bask in the imperial glory and have statues built of them in Washington, D.C. and all that. That's what Hamilton was all about. And so we did make proposals like that, and people did treat him like the nut that he was. But that's why, you know, there was an article, Irving Kristol, who used to call himself the godfather of neoconservatism, wrote an article in his son's tabloid, the Weekly Standard, before he died. Of course, he didn't write anything after he died, but before he died, he wrote, saying, okay, yeah, I'm the godfather of neoconservatism, but what does that mean? And one of the things he said is our favorite president is Theodore Roosevelt, and Teddy Roosevelt was a Hamiltonian. So this whole, you know, he was like this, you know, let's pick on the Philippines and show them who's boss. And he ended up orchestrating the killing of hundreds of thousands of Filipinos. For what? Because they did not want to be a part of the American Empire after just having left the Spanish Empire. So yeah, that the HBO series, I think, was right on that part of it. I didn't like the HBO story on Adams too much because they downplayed the Sedition Act part of it, which was really awful. I mean, they had just passed the First Amendment to the Constitution a few years earlier, and the first thing the Federalist Party of Hamilton did was to outlaw free speech in a law that would go out of existence the day John Adams left office. So the only people who would ever be prosecuted were the Jeffersonians, which they were. They even threw a member of Congress from New England named Lyons, Congressman Lyons, in prison. He was a Revolutionary War veteran. They chained him, they manacled him, made him march through his hometown, and then put him in prison for merely criticizing John Adams. And then, but his sweet revenge was that when Jefferson ran for president, it was a tie in the Electoral College, and so it went to Congress, the House of Representatives, to vote, and the Congressman Lyons cast the deciding vote to get Thomas Jefferson elected president. So he ultimately got his revenge. But that's the sort of dirty pool they were playing back then. Yes, sir? About what? Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, Lincoln closed down more than Lysander Spooner's post office. Lysander Spooner had a red-hot hatred of Abe Lincoln and his regime. There are some letters. If you want to read about it, go online. There are a couple. I think Randy Barnett has a Lysander Spooner website. There are letters to Senator Charles Sumner, and there's a letter to William Seward, the Secretary of State, from Spooner. And I assume they're on Randy Barnett's website. He has just tons of stuff. Because I have read them online. I don't know if it's Randy's website or somebody else's. Anything so, Rod? Okay, yeah. Well, you read those, and Spooner, he calls General Grant the chief murderer of the war, and he's just fuming over the fact that, Spooner wrote a book once called The Unconstitutionality of Slavery. And he thought you could make a legal constitutional case to peacefully end slavery. He also wrote a book on how to nullify the Fugitive Slave Act as sort of a guide to how to essentially not pay attention to the Fugitive Slave Act. And so he wrote these fiery letters to these Lincoln administration people claiming that they're just sort of mass murderers for big business, essentially, that could have ended slavery peacefully all along. And so if you're interested in this topic, I highly recommend it. Spooner is a great writer and a real bomb tosser. He'd probably, if he were alive today, he would probably be living in a nice warm climate someplace like Guantanamo Bay. Yeah. Yes, sir. We have a few more minutes. Oh, I don't know much about that. What ties, if any? I know his ties were to the New York Philadelphia bankers. He didn't need to have ties to European bankers. He was He was the water carrier for Robert Morris and his business buddies. That's well known. You don't need to search any farther than that. That's even Ron Chernow writes about that. And that's who funded his career. When he left the Constitutional Convention, he went to New York to consult with Morris and all his other business partners about what are we going to do now? They're not going to adopt our plan. So you don't need to investigate or ask people if he had ties to European bankers. He was an American. He was the political water carrier of American bankers. So, but I don't know much about the Rothschild thing. I am asked that all the time, but I don't think there's much to it with Hamilton. He was sort of as Murray Rothbard called him, he politely called him Morris's youthful disciple. You know, Morris's youthful disciple. Well, I'm not the Rothschild's youthful disciple. Any other questions or brilliant declarations or anything like that? How about you? Not that I know of. You know, Hamilton really was poorly educated on the topic of economics and finance. His advocates who write books about him, like John Steele Gordon, who wrote a book on Hamilton's Blessing, is the name of the book. That's where I got the idea for my book, Hamilton's Curse. They all say the same thing, that, he worked as a clerk for slave-owning molasses traders on the island of St. Croix as a teenager. And therefore, he's supposed to be far superior to Thomas Jefferson in his economic understanding. But Jefferson was a farmer, after all. What does he know about economics? But, you know, if you walk into Monticello tomorrow, Jefferson's home, you walk in, you turn around like this, you'll see a bust of Turgot. His name is up here somewhere. The finance minister, Turgot. French finance minister, and he was a precursor of the Austrian school, Turgot. And so Jefferson read Adam Smith, Turgot, John Baptiste Say, and the Physiocrats. He was very... What's that, Rod? Yeah, Destut de Trust. He translated from the French. His name is up here. De Tracy is up here somewhere, too. And so it really is an outrage that people like John Steele Gordon say things like this, like Jefferson was an economic ignoramus, whereas Hamilton, you know, he worked for molasses traders. He knew what he was doing. It's like saying my son is a genius because he got a job at McDonald's. He should have a PhD in economics. After all, he's been working at McDonald's for 5 years. You know, and he must know everything there is to know about business. And working at, that's pretty much what they say. So it sort of outrages me. They say that. That's why I think the last thing I'll say on this, since I was trashing John Steele Gordon, when the Great Depression occurred, John Steele Gordon wrote an article in Forbes, I believe it was Forbes, blaming the Great Recession of 2007 on Thomas Jefferson and Ron Paul. Honest to God, I'll give anybody who wants to read it, I'll give you the link in the footnote. And his argument was that the reason for the Depression is that the Fed does not have enough power. Why does it not have enough power? Well, this idea, this anti-central bank ideology that began with Thomas Jefferson and is carried forward today by people like Ron Paul, stood in the way of the Fed having enough power to prevent the Great Depression of 2007. Therefore, if we give the Fed more unlimited power, we will end the Great Depression. I wrote about it. You can look up my critique of this. I wrote a response to him on lewrockwell.com. His article was called A Short Banking History of the United States. It was the Wall Street Journal, not Forbes, Wall Street Journal. My response was called A Fake Banking History of the United States. And so if you look up A Fake Banking History of the United States on Lew Rockwell, you see my response to John Steele Gordon. And he apparently got quite ticked off at it. I did a radio interview about this article, and the radio host had also interviewed Gordon, and he told me what he was saying about me, because these big shot establishment apologists aren't used to having criticism. they all get their own TV shows and all their book contracts and all that, and they're not used to internet sniping. But like I said this morning, basically what we do here at the Mises Institute is we understand you can't fight City Hall, but you can pee on the steps and run away. That's so we do a lot of that. My time is about up. Thank you.